Council. We're here on Range versus Attorney General, appellate number 21-2835, the Court of Appeal for Mr. Gottlieb.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Michael Gottlieb. I represent Brian Range. A little bit of history, I think, is in order for Mr. Range and his family. In 1994, Mr. Range was trying to raise his family. He had a pair of two-year-old twins and a three-and-a-half-year-old child.
Mr. Gottlieb, we are familiar with Mr. Range's, the circumstances arising around from your briefing, around the conviction that kind of brings us here today. And so we would like to sort of get to the heart of the matter and Bruin.
All right.
The question, you know, we'd like to ask you about is, how is Range among the people, that put that in quotes, covered by the plain text of the Second Amendment in light of what you're going to, we already know you were going to tell us about Mr. Range.
All right. First of all, Mr. Range was not a violent offender. And what's important under Bruin is that individuals who are not violent are not normally disarmed under the Second Amendment. And Bruin,
nothing in Bruin speaks to who can lawfully carry. And of course, Justice Alito went out of his way to say that in concurrence. We have on our books precedent from our en banc decision in Binderup in two subsequent decisions, our court's position that it is a virtuous citizen model that is the dividing line between lawful and unlawful regulations. Since Bruin did not purport to address that issue and didn't abrogate that aspect of the courts of appeals decisions, are we still bound by that?
I would suggest we are not bound by the Third Circuit's very, at the time, well thought out precedent. I believe Bruin requires us to look at whether or not Mr. Range is a dangerous individual. And that was set forth, as you'll recall, in that one of the Binderup concurrence opinions, I believe it was Judge Ambrose, believed that dangerousness was the more appropriate factor to look at.
Well, to get a more basic question, Mr. Gottlieb, is it your contention that 921 is unconstitutional?
It is unconstitutional as applied to my client only. We don't purport to contend that it is unconstitutional as to everybody else. We believe that Mr. Range is a virtuous citizen, even if we were to follow the existing law in this circuit. The court, we believe, erred in determining that Mr. Range that the offense was serious. And I say this because there are several ways to break down a fraud conviction. Mr. Range's case was very specific. It was welfare fraud. More specifically, failure to report all his income.
Most specifically, taking the taxpayers' money without any right to it.
Your Honor, I don't disagree with you. He did not have the right to do what he did. And sadly, had he had an attorney, we wouldn't be here. In my opinion, he would have received ARD, which I'm sure all members of the bench here are familiar with. But I would suggest he is a virtuous citizen, and he's virtuous because he satisfies all five tests. The court placed an undue burden on Mr. Range to determine whether or not his the cross-jurisdictional consensus was so important. There were only 25 states that determined that the specific charge of welfare fraud was today a felony.
Does that have any relevance to us anymore?
I'm sorry?
Judge Krause, go ahead, and then Judge Roth.
Does the search for a jurisdictional consensus have any relevance at this point if we are just looking and focused on history and tradition?
I don't believe it does. And I think that's why the trial court, of course, not knowing that Bruin was going to be decided the way it was, I don't think the judge should have been looking at the cross-jurisdictional consensus. Mr. Range clearly wasn't dangerous. He isn't dangerous today. He's had 26 years of living a stellar life.
Well, let's talk about what you mean by dangerous, or you've also spoken a little earlier about violence. If we are to look at history and tradition, then why shouldn't we draw from colonial era and predecessor statutes that allowed for dispossession in situations where there was a disagreement about religious faith? You know, for example, Quakers refusing to take an oath of loyalty.
Yes, they did. And I recall that. And that is true. They did allow it. But at some point, we have to look at is that appropriate history to look at? Because there is other history, specifically with respect to violent individuals who could buy back their virtue by paying a fine after a period of 3 years.
We can talk separately about restoration of rights. But if we're to look at history and tradition, and we have statutes from the relevant period that allowed for disarmament, yes, when there was violent offenses, but also where there were nonviolent offenses, such as the Quakers, where surely you're not arguing that there was a concern about them engaging in a violent uprising.
No, I'm not. But if you'll recall, there are statutes that would allow individuals to not be disarmed, because back in colonial eras, it was important to have firearms, not just to feed your family, but also to protect yourself. And there are statutes to that effect, that one who steals does not have to lose their firearms rights.
So why isn't that just to say that in the relevant period, that the legislature had broad discretion about which types of offenses were appropriate for disarmament, and that that level of deference should carry forward?
Well, in the 1700s, they did. But if you'll recall in Bruin, the court talks about the new statutes that have come out recently, I believe beginning in the 1960s, and the 1990s, disarming people who are non-dangerous, non-violent.
Judge Roth, I know you have a question.
I wanted to ask you, Mr. Gottlieb, what is your position then when you're saying that this does not qualify as a felony about 922G?
I'm sorry. Well, today
it specifically says that it. A conviction of a felony or of a state conviction of a misdemeanor that carries a penalty of more than 2 years shall be considered a felony under this statute.
Yes, I understand what 922G says, but the relevant factors that we believe Mr. Range has satisfied are the five factors set forth in Binderup and so on. And we believe the trial court placed undue weight on the one factor of the cross-jurisdictional consensus.
We just ignore the statute?
922, no, we believe it's unconstitutional as to Mr. Range only.
Mr. Gottlieb, are you saying to us that our Binderup decision, which is the first part of it, which included two components, its views about virtuousness and those considerations for determining whether a crime is serious, survives Bruin?
I do not believe it does. I believe Bruin has struck down these two-step analysis.
No, it stopped. I'm just asking whether the first step, and this first step, the Binderup court says only the virtuous can have guns. People who commit serious crimes are not virtuous. What's a serious crime? And then there are those factors, some of which you've alluded to. My question for you is, do you think that piece of Binderup is still good law? I know the means and stuff part has been rejected, but I'm asking you about the first part.
No, because I believe that Bruin specifically stated that the two-tier analysis is not appropriate, and it was a creation of, I'll call it today, and not yesteryear.
I recognize that. That's not my question. My question is, because you've asked Judge, in answer to Judge Krause and Judge Roth, you kept talking about the district court erred when it applied its consideration of the five factors, including its reliance on cross-jurisdictional. I understood your responses to their questions to say that part of Bruin still survives. I'm sorry, that part of Binderup survives.
Well, no, I'm arguing because we have the initial decision. Bruin obviously came down, as you know, well after the district court decision. And therefore, I it's my contention that none of Binderup survives Bruin.
Okay, if none of Binderup survives Bruin, Bruin speaks of the people as those who are law-abiding, responsible people.
Yes.
Mr. Range is not law-abiding as he has a prior conviction. So doesn't that language in Bruin, without any other consideration, require us to conclude Mr. Range is not covered by the text of the Second Amendment?
No, I believe you need to look at the history as to whether or not he specifically would lose his firearms rights in colonial times. And the answer based on the history is he would not have lost his firearms rights in colonial times.
But if he had committed this offense in colonial times, he could have been prosecuted for larceny or false pretenses, or potentially even forgery if the document was forged in some way, but even if it weren't. And that those times, those offenses were punished by very severe punishments. Can we take anything from that? That in colonial times, had he committed the same crime, he could have faced a maximum of larceny was a capital crime.
I believe that would not be relevant today because, I'm sorry, I believe in his situation that the theft, and it's a very specific theft, getting money from the government that he wasn't entitled to, is a situation where he would not have had his firearms rights taken from him.
Well, if we compare this to Binderup, if we compare this to Bruin, the condition in Bruin was who could carry a gun openly in public. And the historical discussion there was as to did that exist, and it did not. The condition here, we're looking at it at a different angle, because in Bruin, the plaintiffs could carry guns at home. They could have guns at home. It was a question of taking them out of the home. Here, the question is having guns at all. And the issue is because Heller has told us, and Binderup and et cetera, that the prohibition on felons will be recognized. And here we have qualifications as a felon. Isn't your position really the second step under Binderup that's saying, okay, agreed, he would be looked at as a felon, but he should not be characterized as a felon because of X, Y, and Z? Hasn't the burden shifted to you, the government having proven that there was a, quote, felony? The burden has shifted to you beyond the Bruin first step to show that even though he is a felon, he should not be characterized here as a felon, or that he should be able to have his rights restored. And isn't this a consideration which is beyond Bruin, which simply, if we analogize, would be, is he a felony, is he a felon, or is he not a felon? And the answer is yes, but you're saying he should not, in spite of that, that in this case, he should not be considered a felon because of X, Y, Z. That is a step two beyond Bruin. And I think that gives us a different order of precedence and a different requirement on who is going to be persuasive.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, with respect to Mr. Range, he was not a felon. He was a misdemeanant.
He is defined as a felon under 922G.
He would be defined as a felon under 922G, but the important point is he was a misdemeanant under state law.
But 922G covers that. That's decided. If you want to go beyond that and say, okay, that's what the statute says, but this guy should not fit in the definition of felony, aren't you taking a step beyond anything that was decided in Bruin? Aren't you creating a situation where there is a new requirement of order of precedence and a new requirement of burden of persuasion?
Well, I believe, first of all, that the again, I have to go back and say that the trial court erred in determining the cross-jurisdictional consensus was not in our favor. And then we get to the next four steps under Binderup. So we win prior to Bruin, in my opinion.
Mr. Gottlieb, I'm a little confused. Let me go back to the question that I think Judge Schwartz was asking as well. If it's your position that the factors that we had offered up in Binderup are not relevant, why do you keep going back to argue that four of those factors require that the decision here be reversed?
Because the trial court analyzed those factors. Since our case was decided prior to Bruin, we had the Binderup analysis, and we followed the Binderup line of cases throughout our initial brief.
I appreciate that, but we're having argument because this is a purely legal issue. And as a legal issue, isn't it one that we are looking at de novo?
Yes, you are. And I don't think you need to necessarily get to Bruin to decide in our favor under Binderup.
Well, so to what extent is Binderup still relevant?
Well, to my case, it may be.
You know, how so?
But I don't know that it's net. Oh boy, I'm way past my time.
Okay, Judge Krause's question. Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
You could answer Judge Krause's question.
Okay. With respect to the relevance today before this court, I don't know that the Binderup decision is relevant. I think Bruin controls. However, we believe that under Binderup, we carry the day regardless of what Bruin said. I hope that answers your question, or I'm trying to.
You're asking us to ignore Bruin?
No, because I think Bruin assists our case.
So is your view that the only thing that Bruin did was get rid of the second step of Binderup?
No, I think it got rid of the entire two-tier analysis. I believe that's what the court said.
But again, is it your position? So there were sort of two steps in Binderup.
Yes, right? Ma'am.
Okay. And we're in agreement, I believe, that the court was clear in its opinion that the second step is out, right?
No, I believe if you're saying Bruin, I believe Bruin says that this two-tier analysis is out, the entire two-tier analysis.
Well, doesn't the court say that the first step around which the courts of appeals have coalesced is broadly consistent with Heller?
I don't know that the court does say that. And I apologize if I'm misreading Bruin.
Judge Roth, have any further questions?
I have no further questions, thank you.
Judge Krause, any further questions for Mr. Gottlieb?
Yes, just a couple. You seem to be arguing that because welfare fraud in particular wasn't an offense in the 1790s, that's why the government here hasn't carried its burden. But the court is also clear in Bruin that we don't need an identical historical twin. We need an analog. Where we have other offenses, including not just some of those we talked about earlier that relate to disarmament of those who are nonviolent, but had refused to take an oath showing their loyalty and respect for the government, for the rule of law that had been set by the government. And we also have a fairly minor offenses, things like hunting offenses, where there was disarmament for trespassers who were looking for wild geese on the river, for example. Why don't we have sufficient analogies in those types of cases to say that the disarmament that was historically permissible covers both violent and nonviolent offenses?
Well, if we're to look at both violent and nonviolent, there have been ways under statute to buy back your virtue, if you will, particularly the individuals in Shays' Rebellion.
Again, you're talking about reinstatement rather than the original finding.
Yeah, I understand that, but that allowed, and that should...
My understanding of Judge Krause's question was she was talking about the original finding of the offense and whether it involved violence, and there she was giving us a list of cases that did not involve violence, and how do you deal with those?
I believe we can go back to look at whether or not the individual passes the steps that were in Bindrup. And the issue in Bindrup was still the cross-jurisdictional analysis, cross-jurisdictional consensus. And the trial court here ignored, in my opinion, the correct cross-jurisdictional consensus. Was it only 25 states, not 39, found that
So you're saying the hell with the history?
No, I'm not. I respect the history very much. And I'm a student of history, and I believe the history does need to be reviewed.
But you're saying that the those steps, including cross-jurisdictional consensus, continue to be relevant to our analysis of whether this is a serious offense?
Yes. I have to say yes.
Okay.
All right then, Mr. Gottlieb, thank you for your arguments. We'll hear from Mr. Greenlee.
May it please the court. My name is Joseph Greenlee. I represent the Amici Curiae Firearms Policy Coalition and FPC Action Foundation. And I would like to please reserve 1 minute of time for a rebuttal.
I just want to confirm that you have the agreement of Mr. Gottlieb to cede rebuttal to your arguments. Am I correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. That it would be granted. You may proceed, counsel.
So the district court must be reversed for two reasons. First, Bruin both invalidated and replaced the Bindrup multi-factor test that the district court applied here. And second, there's no historical tradition of disarming nonviolent persons such as Mr. Range. So Bindrup's multi-factor—
How do you respond to Judge Krause's examples about oath, folks who choose not to take an oath, certain people who had belonged to certain religious faiths, trespassers, individuals who did not commit violent offenses were being disarmed? How do you respond to that history?
Yes, Your Honor. So during the Revolutionary Wars, when loyalists were disarmed, people not faithful to the Patriot cause, and throughout the war, loyalists, as we demonstrate in our brief, loyalists were very dangerous. They were extremely dangerous people. There were insurrections common throughout the colonies during the war. We provided examples in Maryland, Delaware, and North Carolina. The Virginia governor recruited over 3,000 loyalists to fight alongside him in a battle on American soil. And we have correspondence from somebody in a patriot expressing concern about his wife and children having to live alongside loyalists in his communities. So loyalists were viewed as extremely dangerous. Typically, they could get out of somebody accused of being a loyalist who would face disarmament could
What about the laws that disarmed the Catholics?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, those were during the French and Indian War, which was so Catholics were for a long time discriminated in the American colonies. And during that war, they were viewed as agents. Their Protestant leaders viewed Catholics as agents of the foreign power. They shared the same religion as the French king, Louis XV. And so they also could take an oath of allegiance to clarify that they were not siding with the French. And then, but even then they were—
Why doesn't that demonstrate, including their ability to sort of cure the problem by taking an oath, that what was at issue was really the willingness of a citizen to be faithful to the rule of law, to be faithful to the sovereign, not a matter of physical violence or physical danger, but danger to the order that the colonies were trying to create.
Well, Your Honor, because it was really danger that they were concerned about, and that's why the loyalty oaths would exempt them from the bans, because that expressed, that demonstrated that they were not a danger. That the loyalty, the laws in which these people were disarmed was a continuation throughout English and American history, where people, there was a concern about the leaders of the government that there would be an uprising and people would overthrow the government. And
concern, your position is that the concern of Protestants after the Glorious Revolution was that all Catholics posed a danger of violence.
Yes, Your Honor, disarmament practices were based on that. And we see that going back to the Revolutionary War, the 17th.
So we're nonviolent Catholics then, not disarmed?
Well, there was a general concern. I mean, English history isn't a great representative of American history, and things were more narrow. I mean, we saw a more narrow example of these type of disarmament laws where the concern was an uprebellion and rebellion during the Constitutional Convention and New Hampshire's proposal, where...
Let me go back to my question. Were not those Catholics who could establish they were nonviolent, were they not disarmed?
I'm sorry, are you referring to the English history or during the French and Indian War?
I'm referring to English history. We can move up.
Yes, Your Honor. So certainly these laws were abused sometimes. So that was especially evident in the English history, where they would use the excuse that we're disarming dangerous people, disaffected people, and they would use it to attack their political opponents, certainly. And so I think that would...
If that's the case, if we recognize in history that political affiliation was viewed as a proxy for potential danger, potential disruption of the law and order of that society, then why wouldn't we give that same deference to Congress's determination about the commission of a serious offense, like a felony, as a proxy for the disruption of society, something that would support the disarmament in the same way as the proxy of being Catholic, or in other circumstances, being Protestant, or being affiliated with Ann Hutchison, for example?
Well, Your Honor, that's another, I mean, you can, to the extent that it's consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation, which is a focus and a concern about danger. And to go back to these examples in 1770, I mean, a lot of the times the legislature told us why they were doing it. In 1777, New Jersey, the legislature said we're disarming loyalists because it's dangerous. In 1779, Pennsylvania, they said the same thing. It'd be, quote, very improper and dangerous, unquote, for loyalists to be able to possess arms. And we saw in the New Hampshire proposal at the ratifying convention, a more narrow, now when they had their rights in mind and it wasn't a wartime measure. All of these were French and Indian War and the Revolutionary War. These were wartime measures, and we saw them narrowed down in the New Hampshire proposal, which allowed only for disarmament of people engaged in actual rebellion. So this was solved.
You want to talk about proposals, talk about the Pennsylvania proposal that the Supreme Court has recognized as something worthy of great consideration, even if it wasn't adopted. And that plain language says crimes or real danger, suggesting those are two different buckets. So if you want to go back to proposals, tell us how that doesn't undercut your argument that it was limited to only those who were dangerous, which I think you're equivalent to violence.
Yes, Your Honor. So the proposal at the Pennsylvania came after the convention, and it would have allowed disarmament for crimes committed or real danger of public injury. I think that is at least as reasonable, more reasonable in my opinion, to be read as addressing violent crimes for two reasons. First, up until that point, all they had known was disarmament. Throughout American history, it was all disarmament based on preventing upheavals, rebellions, trying to overthrow the government, and also people going armed to the terror of the public, terrorizing the public. So I think if we would need more evidence that they were proposing the first ever prohibition on nonviolent individuals. And the way that statute is worded, it almost seems that the real danger of public injury is a catch-all. So they're intending to talk about violent crimes, but for dangerous activities that are not crimes, they had far fewer crimes back then. Then they added the catch-all, real danger of public injury. So I think—
And how do you reconcile even that position with the 11 or so times in Bruin, they tell us that those people covered by the Second Amendment are the law abiders. They don't say the nonviolent law abiders, they say law abiding responsible people. So I don't know how you reconcile or read in law abiding means only those who didn't commit a violent crime. Tell us how you were able to do that in light of Bruin's repeated language choice.
Sure, Your Honor. So the way that Bruin uses law abiding, it's typically just a note that the plaintiffs in the case were law abiding so that they're establishing that these are in fact people protected by the Second Amendment, and then it moves on with its analysis. So I don't read Bruin at any point as limiting the right to law abiding citizens. I think they're just saying these are people protected by the Second Amendment, and then it goes on with its analysis.
Do you attach any significance to the fact that they reference law abiding citizens no less than 11 times in the opinion?
Well, certainly significance to the extent that law abiding citizens are unquestionably protected by the Second Amendment.
What about footnote 9, where the court goes out of its way to say that nothing in our analysis could be interpreted to suggest the unconstitutionality of the 43 states shall issue licensing regimes that don't prevent law abiding responsible citizens from exercising their Second Amendment right to public carry? Those states' licensing regimes, of course, limit the issuance of a license to those who have not committed a felony, a felony as defined in federal law, no less. So how much more explicit could the court be in saying that is not a constitutional problem?
Well, Your Honor, I could be more explicit by saying that this right is limited to law-abiding citizens, and they never say that. I think that footnote is just it's a footnote explaining that if one of these shall issue permitting schemes applied to these law-abiding citizens at issue in this case, that would probably be constitutional. I don't think, if they laid out the test twice in the Bruin decision, and if they wanted some exception for felons, I think they would have just come out and said so.
They did say that both in Bruin that. Justice Kavanaugh and the Chief, and also Justice Alito, give the nod to the idea that the presumptively lawful felon in possession statutes, that reassurance provided in Heller and McDonald still stands.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that is an expression, because we know that it's not part of the test, because Bruin laid out the test first on the slip opinion, page 10, and then it said we're going to reiterate the test on the slip opinion, page 15. Each time it said the government has the burden of proving that its regulation is consistent with the historical tradition in this country, and neither time it provided any exception saying, except for the presumptively lawful laws that we identified in Heller, or except for prohibitions for felons, or anything like that. So I think the test applies to everyone, and because this presumptively lawful language doesn't play into the test,
your position that 921 facially is constitutional?
Your Honor, I believe that it's unconstitutional as applied to nonviolent felons.
But facially it's constitutional. There are as applied circumstances. Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And do I understand you correctly in arguing that the presumption that the longstanding prohibitions on possession by laws that are regulating possession by felons doesn't survive Bruin?
Well, I believe that expression is an expression of their expectation that these laws will be upheld. But going back to the longstanding part of that sentence, they say longstanding prohibitions for felons. The federal felon ban is 27 years newer than the law struck down in Bruin, and as applied to nonviolent felons, that came 50 years after the law that was struck down in Bruin. So I don't think we can say the federal felon ban is longstanding if they struck down Bruin without giving it any kind of presumptive validity.
How do you reconcile the idea that disarmament is limited to those who commit violent offenses with the numerous hunting misdemeanors on the books where, you know, whether it's deer or wild geese, that hunting as a trespasser or at night was a basis for disarmament?
Your Honor, I don't know of any laws that would prohibit possession of firearms based on hunting. I know there were somewhere if you got caught hunting on somebody else's land with your firearm, those firearms could be confiscated, but not, it didn't prohibit you from possessing firearms. So that's very different than an all-out prohibition that we're dealing with here.
So the hunting regulations you read as simply forfeiting the firearm that you were using at the time, but not forfeiting firearms as a more general matter?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And is it your position that the only individuals not covered by the people in the Second Amendment are those who are a danger, which you equate to violence? Am I correct to understand what you think it covers?
Your Honor, I believe that Judge Hardiman put it most precisely in his Binder concurrence, where he said people who either have a propensity for violence or who have shown that they are likely to use firearms for illicit purposes. So I think there's some people who maybe they haven't demonstrated violence, but they've demonstrated danger in some way or another that you could consider to fall outside of the scope of the Second Amendment.
And why follow the Supreme Court efforts to try to define crime of violence?
Your Honor, I understand that has been an issue, I believe, in that Johnson case, but I would say that I think it would actually add clarity here with the Binderup multi-factor test. Not only we have different factors that come in from case to case, and like, for example, I don't know that anyone is quite certain which factors will apply here, but that fifth factor, I'm sorry, but I mean of the parties, will that fifth factor from Holloway, the risk of harm, be considered or not here? It was not in Falajatar. So not only do we have kind of different factors in this ever-evolving test, but we also have the factors have different weights from case to case. So in
I just want to ask you about Binderup, then a question that I tried to ask Judge Mr. Gottlieb and that Judge Krause asked. Does Binderup Part 1, and when I define Part 1, I'm talking about its observation about virtuousness and the factors for valuing whether something is a serious crime, does that survive Bruin?
I do not believe so, Your Honor. At least three of the factors are, I don't believe, relevant anymore under
Bruin. Why don't you just tell me to talk about Binderup and Holloway and those factors?
Well, I was just saying that I think it would be more clear. I think a tester would certainly be some issues, some close calls. Is this person dangerous or not? I admit certainly there would be some kind of close calls on that, but I still think it would be a clearer issue than having to go through all these factors that change weight, which one matters in this case.
This is an as applied. Is this person a danger? That's not what Bruin tells us we should be looking at. Bruin tells us we should be looking at it historically. The kind of regulation at issue would have precluded the conduct we're evaluating. So why are we talking about this person?
Well, Your Honor, Bruin tells us that the regulation that applies to this person has to be consistent with the historical tradition of regulation.
Regulation itself has to be consistent with history. The regulation that you cannot carry a gun abroad in New York City, whether you're a good citizen or a bad citizen. And that's all they had to decide. They were looking at it facially. Now, when you want to get into as applied considerations, that's basically the Binderup second step. And that's basically what Bruin has said is not no longer valid. That is if you analogize Bruin to this case, the condition similar to Bruin of carrying a gun abroad, looking at it facially, is being a felon. And that is easily satisfied. If we look at Heller, if we look at the statute We don't even have to look at history because we look at what the Supreme Court is telling us today. Now, the argument here is, well, okay, maybe it's valid facially, but that's as applied. That is getting beyond Bruin. Bruin never looked at as applied. Bruin looked at the statute overall to look at the as applied aspects of either the statute in Bruin or the statute here. You have to go beyond anything that has been established in Bruin. And I think we're on our own. I think we can turn to the learning that we have in our own cases to determine as applied, whether this is just a misdemeanor matters, whether there should be a right to get the right back matters. But that has gone beyond the facial aspects of Bruin. The as applied aspects here are something that Bruin never talked about.
Your Honor, what Bruin makes clear is that any firearm regulation must be consistent with the historical tradition of
and
nations.
And the firearm and facially, the firearm restriction to felons is consistent not only with history, it's consistent with what the Supreme Court has told us we have to do.
Well, at least three of the multi-factor test factors have no foundation in history. Let's say, for example,
so you're saying ignore the Supreme Court?
No, Your Honor, I'm quite the contrary. I'm saying follow the Supreme Court and ensure that this regulation is applied to Mr. Range is consistent with the nation's tradition.
But we're following Bruin, and Bruin is not an as-applied case.
But Bruin sets out the test that applies to all Second Amendment challenges, including this one.
Test. But if we go on to as-applied consideration, we are going beyond Bruin, and we aren't bound by Bruin.
First of all, Your Honor, I believe that Bruin was, I believe Mr. Nash, and I forget the other name of the plaintiff, but I think it was an as-applied challenge. But secondly, Second Amendment regulation still must be consistent with the history and tradition. And
what factors that you're saying are relevant in assessing history and condition and history?
Well, two of the multi-factor test factors would still survive, in my opinion, the use of violence and the risk of danger. As far as the misdemeanor felony conviction, the distinction, there's no historical evidence that disarmament ever depended on whether a crime was a misdemeanor or felony. The sentence imposed as opposed to the maximum possible sentence, there's no evidence that that was ever a consideration. And the cross-jurisdictional consensus is especially problematic because that looks around the country at 2022 at what laws exist. And Bruin said that nothing from the 1900s is worth considering because it's so far removed from the founding. And even the late 1800s was relevant only to the extent that it informed the history that had already been discovered.
So if we accept your position that the dividing line is violent offenses, from your view of history and your scholarship, we would not need to distinguish between misdemeanors for violent offenses and felonies for violent offenses. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. There were plenty of violent misdemeanors that people were executed for in historically or that demonstrated danger that the person could not be trusted with firearms. So yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
I was going to ask if Judge Roth had any other questions. Go ahead, Judge Krause.
So you keep talking about danger, but as we discussed earlier, there were plenty of laws on the books at the time, including the test acts in Pennsylvania or states, that used a characteristic of a person, not a characteristic that itself reflected violence, but used that characteristic as a proxy for violence. Why wouldn't that apply just as well to saying, well, people who disobey the laws, who have demonstrated disrespect for the rule of law by breaking a law punishable by more than a year or misdemeanors more than 2 years, that is a proxy for someone who dangerous to society, no less than someone who has a personal religious belief that salvation permits them to violate the law, for example.
I believe that falls just too far outside of the scope of the historical. So in Bruin, the court considered 14 different carry restrictions throughout those relevant periods and determined that that was insufficient to establish a tradition. I think pointing to maybe one law that can be interpreted either way is just insufficient to say, sure, all nonviolent people can be disarmed if they just show a disregard for the law. I don't think that has the necessary foundation in our country's history.
Well, I'm sorry, you're saying one law, but as we discussed, this seemed to come up in numerous different settings. People who were, by their convictions, nonviolent, but were unwilling to take an oath as to who had ultimate sovereignty. If that's a proxy for someone who is dangerous, why wouldn't the violation of the laws of the country be an even more telling proxy of potential danger?
Because these laws that applied to these nonviolent people, first of all, they were of a suspected class. These were wartime measures, people of a suspected class who then refused to take the extra step of signing an oath saying, I'm not going to side with the enemy against you. So that's a different scenario than just somebody who, now, if there's a nonviolent criminal today who keeps trying to go online and start some rebellion against the government, that would certainly fall within what the people were concerned about in 1777 New Jersey and whatnot. But there has to be some danger involved, not just a disregard for the law.
I guess I'm still trying to understand how the if it's enough simply to be affiliated with the Quakers or affiliated with Catholicism, unwilling to take an oath, why that in and of itself shows danger.
Well, because they were concerned that these people would rebel against the government. And we saw, and another thing, some of those were like English laws, the French and Indian War, and then Revolutionary War, again, another wartime measure. And I think we need to go back to the New Hampshire law, the proposal at their convention, which only disarmed people if they were engaged in actual rebellion. I think that's a more narrow law that was during relatively peacetime, where they were factoring in both the people's rights and freedoms, and also the protection of the government from a rebellion. So I think that's the one. As far as we're looking into people being disarmed for being disloyal, I think that's the one we really need to focus on to see what the founders were thinking.
Could we step back to one of Judge Schwartz's early questions? Because it appears that there's discussion in Bruin and Heller as well about the people. And is the assessment of who are the people a different step of the analysis after Bruin than looking to the historical analogy of an offense, or do those things collapse into one question?
So, Your Honor, I believe it's the same as Heller, and Bruin clarified how we're supposed to do that. So Bruin says, and it says this is what Heller did. We look to the plain text of the Second Amendment to see if the individual's conduct is covered. And if so, then we go to the government's presumption and proving that the regulation is historically consistent. The people, as far as that plain text meaning, Heller already did all that analysis. That's about the first half of the Heller opinion. And it concluded with the people that there's a strong presumption that all Americans are protected by the Second Amendment. And then you would go to the government's presumption. And that's where that presumptively lawful language from about longstanding prohibitions for felons comes in. It's deep, same as restrictions on dangerous and unusual weapons, sensitive places, and all that. So that comes in the historical tradition part, where the government bears a burden.
Who fall outside of the people?
Well, there's certainly a question about non-citizens And there's a question about, I'd say violent felons and people who present a danger to the public for Second Amendment purposes fall outside. But there's a presumption all Americans are, and then the government has to come in, and it's their burden to demonstrate who's not included in that.
Judge Roth, do you have any further questions for counsel?
I have no further questions.
Judge Krause.
Can you give us some examples of felonies where historically they did not carry with them disarmament?
Yes, Your Honor. Actually, larceny, which the government depends on here, that's their analogy as to larceny. So in their discussion, their supplemental brief on pages 7 and 8, they cite Falajatar on page 905, which references mm-hmm. in its larceny discussion and the historical analogies. It cites through the 1790, the first Congress enacted a series of criminal laws, and larceny was a crime. It was punished by public whipping of up to 39 stripes, and then the government could recover up to 4 times the amount that the person of the value of the goods that the person stole. But the person would still retain their arms rights. It was unaffected. And we know from the 1792 Militia Act that came right after that, that not only was such a person allowed to possess arms, but he was going, if it's an able-bodied male between 18 and 45, he was required by that Militia Act to possess arms.
So how should we think about the level of generality or specificity in the analogy that we're directed to in Bruin? Do we need to look offense by offense, or can we step back and talk more generally about offenses that involve violence or as the government would have it, felony or misdemeanor offenses? At what level of generality following Bruin do we need to identify analogies?
Well, so this is a fundamental constitutional right, of course, so it needs to be, it can't be taken away just from somebody who doesn't fall within that historical tradition of regulation. So I think it's important to find that common thread that ran through the tradition, so dangerousness, and then, so certain offenses when unquestionably, let's say like armed robbery, attempted murder, that kind of stuff, like no question about that. And then, I think it needs to be left pretty vague, not vague, but dangerousness to the extent where somebody who's a little closer to the line can come in and the government will have to prove that they do fall within the scope of those restrictions. So I'm not sure that answers your question perfectly well, but I think there needs to be a little room for some as-applied challenges where the government has to give a closer showing. But at the same time, it can be described as something like danger, where clearly violent acts fall within it, and there won't be a bunch of as-applied challenges from attempted murders or something like that.
So how would we identify what is a dangerous offense as you would apply the history?
Well, either a person who shows a propensity of violence, so somebody who, armed assault, something like that, or a likelihood that they would use firearms for illicit purposes. So if they demonstrate kind of a violent behavior that intentionally put other people at risk, something along those lines.
But doesn't breaking the law itself carry with it those concerns?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Somebody who gets 4 parking tickets over the course of 2 years is consistently breaking the law, but I don't think that represents any likelihood that that person is more likely to go commit a violent act with a firearm than somebody who doesn't get those parking tickets, for example.
Let's say instead of having a firearm that commits some assault against the United States, someone comes up with a scheme to diminish the coffers, the fisc, then there's no money to run the government. Would you say that person poses a danger?
To the extent that it it jeopardizes the safety of the nation, certainly. Yes.
Thank you. Judge Krause, anything else, or can we turn it over to the government?
I think we can turn it over to the government. Thank you.
Very good. All right, counsel, thank you, Mr. Greenlee. All right, Mr. Soder.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Kevin Soder from the Department of Justice for the government. I think it might be helpful to just very briefly take a step back and situate where we are here. We're talking about a longstanding cornerstone of federal gun safety legislation. And under that legislation, individuals convicted of crimes punishable by more than a year of imprisonment are generally prohibited from possessing firearms. The district court carefully applied this court's precedent to determine that the plaintiff failed in his as-applied challenge to that statute. And so we're here only because plaintiff's sort of last chance is to convince this court that Bruin somehow changed this court's binding step one analysis. But it,
we disagree that it did change the burden of proof, right? Our case law had put the burden on the defendant, and it's clear under Bruin that burden rests with the government. Right?
I think Bruin certainly establishes that the government must affirmatively prove that its firearm regulation is consistent with the nation's history and tradition. But this court already concluded that this firearm regulation on its face is consistent with that tradition. And that was also, of course, consistent with the Supreme Court's repeated assurances that it's talking about a right that belongs to law-abiding citizens, and with the Supreme Court's specific express endorsement of prohibitions on felon possession. And so I think that's where this court gets to in the Bindrup decision and in the subsequent published cases applying it. This idea that once you're talking about a facially constitutional, presumptively lawful regulation, someone who's saying my as applied challenge should nonetheless succeed needs to make some sort of a strong showing to overcome the showing the government has already made about the numerous situations in which this statute can constitutionally be applied. And I think that's clear in the way that this court talked about it in Bindrup. And it's also a point on which I think the court was in unanimous agreement that a strong showing is necessary to overcome this law that the Supreme Court had expressly referred to as lawful.
But Bruin says that the analogy isn't meant to be a regulatory blank check, right?
Correct. I believe that language is in Heller as well. And that's the same sort of test that this court applied. And that's why, you know, this court extracted from its step one analysis, which, you know, as we've discussed, we're not relying on what was step two of Bindrup in light of.
Now that we're directed to focus heavily, if not exclusively, on history and tradition, and also admonished to look for close analogs, not necessarily identical, but also not at a level of generality that would sweep in protected conduct. So why shouldn't we then be looking for analogs that that very closely mirror the particular offense? And how have you met your burden? If that's the standard, how have you met your burden here with, a theft of a relatively small amount of funds from the government?
So to the first part of your question, Your Honor, I think the court made clear in Bruin that it was applying the history standard that had previously been adopted in Heller, which is the same standard that this court debated, of course, at length among the various opinions in Bindrup. And this court looked at that history, looked for relevant analogs, and 10 of the 15 judges on the en banc court at that time concluded that serious crimes are what can today be constitutionally support disarmament over the objection that the test should be danger. That same danger test that Amicus is relying on is the historical support that Judge Hardiman was citing. And nothing has changed about that history, and certainly nothing in the Supreme Court's decision is in conflict with this court's binding case law, which is, I think, the required standard under this court's case law for when the Supreme Court's cases would overtake binding precedent.
But to the extent that Bruin is telling us to look for closer analogies, not just the broad brush of any offense punishable by more than a year.
But are those closer analogies considering the facial validity of the statute or in considering the as-applied validity of the statute? Does Bruin, in fact, go into an as-applied consideration in the Supreme Court opinion?
I think that the Supreme Court was concerned there with the facial validity of the statute and with to the extent it was an as-applied challenge, as amicus counsel suggested, it was a challenge brought by people who were law-abiding. And the court stressed in its opinion at least 11 times, as I think some of the questions were pointing out, that it was talking about the right of law-abiding citizens. And when it talked about the need to draw historical analogies, the court said that the question is, quote, how and why the regulations burden a law-abiding citizen's right to armed self-defense. This court, in its existing case law, focused on that law-abiding qualification that was in Heller to conclude that the relevant historical analogy is that serious offenses can support disarmament. And I think, you know, a fresh analysis of the history would, of course, reflect that that was that it was a correct decision to reject this narrow focus on violence. But I don't think that, you know, that the question before this court is what history shows as an initial matter. If we were there, I think we would be talking more about the position advanced by Judge Fuentes, that history supports application of this statute in its full sweep. The reason we're here talking about this multi-factor test is that we recognize that there is binding precedent on this issue, and we are following that precedent, and we think the district court correctly applied it, and that there's nothing in conflict with it from the Supreme Court.
It's the government's position that this panel doesn't even have discretion to discuss a different test, that we are bound by Binderup and Holloway and Felogitar, and it would require another en banc court to revisit the criteria that we have already announced for a serious offense?
Yes, I think those criteria do remain binding. Of course, this court I wouldn't go so far as to say it has no discretion to the extent the court wishes to explain why the history, explain again, as Felogitar did, for example, why the history supports the conclusion that this binding precedent already requires. The court, of course, could do so. And I think the discussion of history in Felogitar is very helpful on that point as well in reinforcing the conclusions that Binderup reached on what the appropriate historical analogies are. And I think the court has already touched on some of those, but just in case it's helpful, I saw sort of three categories of historical analogies to support this endorsement of a seriousness test rather than a dangerousness one. One is these precursors to the Second Amendment. The Pennsylvania proposal from the Anti-Federalists was particularly prominent there. But in Felogitar, the court also talked about proposals in New Hampshire and Massachusetts and explained that those are not limited to dangerousness. The second sort of bucket I think the court has highlighted in its cases are disarmament laws around at the time of the colonies that, again, were not limited to violence or dangerousness. And the third, I think, of particular relevance here is the ubiquity of capital punishment and other serious penalties for offenses that would have been felonies at the time of the founding. And those together, I think, help reinforce the correctness of this court's conclusions. But it's not up to this panel, I think, to revisit it.
But Mr. Greenlee has made the point that the death penalty was not in practice enforced. So why is simply pointing to what was on the books, but as a practical matter, was not the law of the land a helpful analogy?
I think for the same reason that this court said in Felogitar that the analogies between the crime that Lisa Felogitar committed and crimes that were subject to severe punishment at the time of the founding supports application of the statute to her. And of course, that's in line with conclusions reached in a number of circuits often under the sort of pre-Bruin step one history and tradition focus, that this court would be a complete outlier if it were to say that someone who willfully defrauded the government of public assistance funds is someone who has a Second Amendment right, who falls within the scope of the right that the Supreme Court has repeatedly insisted belongs to the law-abiding citizens, not to those who show this sort of disrespect for the laws.
What do you say to Mr. Greenlee's point? There are felony offenses that we can look back on to say there was not disarmament. There may have been other significant punishments, but disarmament was not among them. If that's the case, and we have to look sort of offense by offense to whether our founding fathers thought that disarmament was appropriate, don't we have to go through the same kind of offense by offense analysis today?
No, Your Honor, I think the court already rejected this sort of offense by offense analysis, both for reasons rooted in history and as well as just recognizing the administrative nightmare that I think that would cause on the courts, and that would be inconsistent with the historical support that that underlies the court's conclusion in Bindrup and in Holloway and Falajtar. This is precedent on precedent on precedent, all on this very specific question of as-applied challenges to 922G1, none of which has been undermined by the Supreme Court, and if anything, has been reaffirmed by it. So I think it would be extraordinary to revisit that based on what amounts to exactly the same argument that was being made in Bindrup. And of course, you know, we recognize that there was disagreement among the judges about what the right standard is and what the history shows, but we're past that. We have this established framework. You know, we're living with it and explaining why it supports the district court's decision in this case.
Counsel, I need you to back up in the analysis. I want to track Bruin, because what I'm hearing you say is parts of Bindrup survive. We need to be informed by it. We don't need to look at historical analogies. I think I heard you say that, which seems to be inconsistent, and I hope I misheard you with what the court said. So let me back you up. The first part of Bruin says, does the Second Amendment cover or give protection to the individual? What is your argument concerning just that point?
Concerning just that point, the Second Amendment's protections extend to law-abiding citizens, whether analyzed as a question of text, history, or a combination of the two. This court has already ruled based on the express endorsement of felon dispossession laws in Heller and that discussion that.
Okay, so we got law abiders. If you got Second Amendment rights if you're a law abider. Bindrup doesn't use the word law abider, it used the words virtuous. Are they equivalents, or is virtuousness the wrong frame?
I think Bindrup uses the word virtuousness as an understanding of what the historical analogy showed in that controlling opinion. And that's the link that this court drew to sort of the current longstanding federal prohibition on felon possession was the founding era restrictions on non-virtuous citizens, and the understanding that there was no constitutional guarantee to people who were not within that group.
So we've got law abiders, we got the non-virtuous. Those are the two people or groups that are not covered with Second Amendment privileges. Am I understanding you correctly?
I think those are certainly overlapping groups, and I imagine there are more out there. I'm not here trying to go through a exhaustive catalog of which sorts of regulations will be consistent with Bruin when analyzed as a fresh matter. I did want to make sure to clarify. What I was saying about historical analogies was that this court has already done the analogical reasoning that Bruin requires under step one of its pre-Bruin test, which was drawn from the same portions of Heller that Bruin makes clear it was applying. So it's not that it's unnecessary were this a blank slate, it's that we are well past writing on a blank slate.
Let me ask you this though. If we were to agree with you that the Second Amendment does not protect non-law abiders and non-virtuous, don't we just stop because the individual seeking protection has a prior conviction? Doesn't at the end of the analysis, can't we just stop there?
I think that the gloss on virtuousness that controlled after Bindrup and that continues to control in our view is the one under which a multi-factor test would permit someone to show that they do not fall within the historically disarmed group. And that's the analysis that the district court conducted and that we submitted.
But you said it falls under the person who's trying to protect their rights. The Supreme Court says it would be the government's obligation to do this.
I think the point here is that the government has already met its obligation by showing the number of historical analogs that were discussed by this court in Bindrup for disarming people convicted of serious crimes. And having met that burden, I think what Bindrup recognized is that it takes a strong showing by the individual challenger who's saying that facially constitutional, presumptively law can't constitutionally apply to me. It takes a sort of strong showing. And I I mentioned before, I think the court was unanimous on that point. Judge Hardiman referenced the strong showing necessary to overcome.
I'm not talking about Bindurup right now. I'm talking about Bruin. Because Bruin doesn't seem to put any burden, and please correct me if I'm wrong, on any burden on the person who's trying to invoke their rights.
I think Bruin says that someone does have to fall within the text, at which point the government has a burden to affirmatively show the regulation is consistent with history. And whether analyzed as a text question or a history question, this court's decision in Bindurup already addresses why someone who committed a serious crime can be disarmed. And of course, if this court goes beyond that, I think we would be talking about the sorts of more specific analogies beyond just serious crimes generally to fraud and to depriving the government of its funds. And as I think we talked about a bit earlier, there's a significant case law, both from this court in Falashtar and from other courts, refusing to validate an as-applied challenge in that context.
I now want to go back to Bindurup. Bindurup, the first part says, when the Second Amendment's plain text covers an individual conduct, the Constitution presumptively protects that conduct. Your argument is this individual's conduct is not covered by the plain text because it's a non-law abider, a non-virtuous, and historically, those who were non-law abiders were disarmed. However, this is how it continues. The court must then, if the person is protected, justify its regulation by demonstrating it is consistent with the nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation. Do we reach that second element in this case?
I think the court has to apply Bindurup, Holloway, and Falashtar. And I think that those cases make clear it is a combination of the text and history that leads to the conclusion that non-law abiding citizens include individuals who commit serious crimes. And that's consistent with what the Supreme Court has said over and over about law-abiding citizens and about these particular disarmament rules.
So where are we applying these Bindurup considerations in the analytical framework? If you were writing the opinion, where is that going? Because your first, presumably, if you were given the pen, you would tell me, you would write, someone like Mr. Range is not covered because he's not a law-abider, he's not virtuous. Historically, folks who committed serious crimes like his were disarmed. Where is Bindurup fitting in this?
I think where Bindurup fits in is there is the controlling opinion that says, okay, the historically barred class is people who commit serious crimes. Bindurup then says, to evaluate seriousness, Judge Amber's opinion looked at several factors to figure out what is the type of serious crime today that's supported by this analogy to non-virtuous citizens at the founding. And this court, Judge Amber went through those factors, and this court has again applied those factors in Holloway and Falashtar.
So you think that to conclude that someone is not virtuous requires us to take an examination of whether that person committed a serious crime. So you think that the Bindurup factors on seriousness survive Bruin?
Yes.
Why do you think that?
Because this court was already looking for exactly the sort of historical analogy that Heller had already demanded and that Bruin reaffirmed. I think Bruin takes pains to make clear it is applying the text and history standard of Heller, not changing it. And that's the same standard that the court's opinions in Bindurup were grappling with.
But what analogy are you drawing to? Analogy to whether or not there were felon in possession firearm bans at the founding, or whether there were like crimes of the sort that Mr. Range committed that led to disarmament? Which regulation are you looking at?
I think both support application of the statute in this case. If we're following sort of the framework of Bindurup, which I think, our position is remains binding, it's the analogy to the non-virtuous, the non-law abiding not being included within the scope of the right. That the Supreme Court has made clear is their understanding of the scope of the right as well. And that's where, as I mentioned before, there can be debate about what the right test is for whether something is serious. And that was debated at length in Bindurup, but a conclusion was reached.
But that's not my question. Judge Roth?
It's my understanding that the appellants here are not questioning the facial constitutionality of 921, they're challenging the as applied. And if facially we're saying 921 is constitutional, doesn't that satisfy Bruin? And as applied, then goes on to an individual consideration of, are these guys really felons? Should these guys have the right to have their rights restored? But that the facial constitutionality of 921 is not questioned. Well, 921 and 922 is not questioned. It's the as applied, and that's where we then can make the consideration historically of whether 922G is valid, whether historically we need to look at what was done or not done back in the 18th century.
Yes, Your Honor, and I think that's the part of the analysis that this court already reached in its previous cases, and that Bruin doesn't conflict with, is Bruin instructs how to evaluate any sort of law, any sort of regulation of conduct under the Second Amendment. This court did that analysis both based on the Supreme Court's existing endorsements of these sorts of laws and based on its own assessment of history. And its conclusion from that history was that the history showed that serious crimes supported disarmament. Then once you are past that general conclusion that the statute is constitutional on its face because it is disarming people who committed serious crimes, you then on an as-applied basis can get into whether someone has managed to distinguish themselves from the historically barred class, but that's not the sort of issue that the court is dealing with directly.
But the issue here is not whether it's valid on its face. The issue is whether it's valid as applied to Mr. Range, right?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's a specific framework that this court adopted in Bindrup and again in Holloway and Falashnar.
I want to go back to Horst's question because I'm not clear what regulation as applied the government thinks is before us. Is it a regulation where someone who commits fraud can be disarmed? Or is it a broad brush? Anyone convicted of an offense, a felony offense punishable by a year, or a misdemeanor punishable by more than 2 years, can be disarmed consistent with the Second Amendment. Which is the regulation that we should be thinking about as applied in this case?
I think it's both, Your Honor, and I don't mean to sort of not answer the question, but I do think it's relevant under Bindra and under the correct analysis, both that we are here because this statute, which bars anyone from possessing a firearm after being convicted of a crime punishable by more than a year, which is the sort of broad brush version that Your Honor's talking about. So we're here because of that, but we're also here because this particular person is bringing an as-applied challenge to that regulation. And that's the scenario that this court has dealt with in its prior cases and has developed this, this framework that we were talking about that relies on a more categorical analogy than just the individual crime in each case, so that which of course ensures the courts aren't inundated with each individual person demanding an analogy specific to their crime. But also the test accounts for the possibility that some crimes will not be within the scope of what was historically supported.
So you concede that there are offenses that would meet the definition of a felony under for 922G purposes, but that would not be consistent with the Second Amendment use for disarmament.
Is that right? As a matter of this circuit's precedent, I think that conclusion is required. If we were working from a blank slate, I think that that we would have a different answer to that question. And that's for the reasons that I think were shown in the divergent opinions in Bindrup, is that the court, the members of the court had different conclusions about If we're just looking at history as an initial matter, what do we conclude? But the court, after that careful analysis that it did of the history and the three sort of divergent opinions, the controlling conclusion is that serious crimes are the touchstone and that some crimes covered by this current statute are not serious under that precedent.
And so what if you're defining seriousness based upon the Binderup-Holloway full chart considerations, which one survived Bruin? Can cross-jurisdictional consensus survive Bruin given its instruction that we look at our history?
Yes, I think they all remain binding precedent because nothing in there is in conflict with Bruin. Of course, for purposes of resolving this case, the court can also rely on the analogy to historical regulations of fraud offenders and the like. And then the court can look to, I think there's sort of no question that the maximum penalty that a legislature sets for a crime, which here, of course, was 5 years. And the reason it's called a misdemeanor is a feature, a quirk of Pennsylvania law. But the five-year maximum is sort of, once they wanted to impose that, the label they had available is a misdemeanor. I think that's also relevant. And the cross-jurisdictional consensus remains relevant too, because it shows that Pennsylvania is not even close to an outlier in imposing this five-year maximum sentence for people who willfully defraud the government or deprive the government.
Can we also look to those more recent cross-jurisdictional consensus points to say that we are relying on, that it's and similar to how these crimes were treated historically, namely this conduct was illegal then and serious punishments followed?
Yes, I think that's another helpful analogy to draw. And of course, we've gone through in the brief some of the examples, which again, come from Falashtar, which is a very similar offense in all but name. And also from, I would refer the court to the DC Circuit's opinion in Medina, I think very helpfully explains why under what was step one, the text and history approach, that person was, I think it was omitting income or failing to report income on a loan application. The Fourth Circuit's decision in Hamilton, the Seventh Circuit's decision in Hatfield. These cases all involve relatively similar facts. Sometimes really quite on point as far as how far in time from the crime to the challenge and how much money was at stake. And they all concluded that under step one, the application of 922G1 or in the case of the Fourth Circuit case of state parallel was constitutional.
If the regulation we're to look at is the felon in possession bar, Bruin tells us, consider whether or not a like regulation which addressed a like societal harm existed in the 18th century. It appears from the briefing, from everybody's research, there was no flat out felon in possession bar, but the nature of a societal harm would have understandably still existed. People who can't be trusted pose a risk. This court then says that if you can't find a distinctly similar historical regulation addressing this problem, then the challenge regulation is inconsistent with the Second Amendment. What do we do with that language?
I think the court recognizes that it's looked for the historical analogies already. And what it's found is that there was no support for the idea that at the time of the founding, someone who had committed a serious offense would have a constitutional right to possess a firearm. The court has exhausted that historical record to reach that conclusion and has repeatedly rejected the idea that violence or danger should be the touchstone. And I would also say that there's, I think, in Bruin itself, as we've talked about, the repeated emphasis on law-abiding citizens, including when it was discussing how to draw an analogy, when Bruin said, the question is how and why the regulations burden a law-abiding citizen's right to armed self-defense. The court was not trying to call into question any of the cases, including the application of Section 922G1, which, of course, is worth remembering, the Supreme Court has multiple times reiterated as a sort of longstanding prohibition that is consistent with the approach adopted in Heller and applied in Bruin.
Thank you, counsel. Judge Krause, you have any further questions?
Yes, if we are to focus on the historical analogy, what do you do with things like the 1970 larceny law that Mr. Greenlee pointed to? If there are examples of serious offenses where the punishments did not include disarmament, then how can we just say that there's enough in any showing of disrespect to the sovereign by breaking the law that a general felon possession law has a sufficient historical analog?
I think this court starts by looking to its precedent, which we've explained remains binding, and then Falashtar, the court specifically relied on the analogy between Lisa Falashtar's offense and a common law offense and an offense early at the founding. So just as in any other case, where if a litigant were to say a legal conclusion reached in a precedent was erroneous because I have some new argument or some new example, or perhaps a new gloss on an example that was already before the court, I'm not sure in the case of that particular example. Just as in that situation, the court would adhere to precedent, so too here. And I think the court made this point very effectively in Falashtar in explaining that if stare decisis means anything, it means we cannot, without gravely impugning stability and legitimacy of the judiciary, revisit a position so recently espoused by a majority of our en banc court and two panels since. And these issues are all going to arguments that that were before the en banc court and that were considered, thought about carefully, and rejected.
Well, you're assuming that those things survived Bruin. Let's assume arguendo that Bruin did clear the slate. So as we look back for examples of history and tradition that would match up with a couple thousand dollars in welfare fraud that didn't even carry with it actual jail time, what is the historical analogy that would satisfy Bruin?
I think if the court were to adopt that assumption, I think, that's a situation in which we would welcome an opportunity to discuss this further in briefs as well, since our briefs have focused on answering the court's question about what aspects of precedent remain binding. I think the court can certainly look to some of the analogies already discussed in that precedent and some of the analogies that were coming up earlier in the discussion about, laws that existed at the founding, understandings that were significant precursors to the Second Amendment, including that Pennsylvania proposal that was specifically flagged by Heller as an influential precursor to the Second Amendment text, and can look to analogical treatment of felonies at the time of the founding, which of course this court looked to in Falashtar as well.
So we do have Bruin telling us that at least two metrics that we need to address to see if it is a sufficiently similar offense. And that is how the regulation burdens a law-abiding citizen's right and why. If we're looking at this offense in particular, what's the answer to the how and the why of the analogies that you think govern?
Well, I think the first answer, of course, is that the court mentioned a law-abiding citizen's right, and this doesn't burden a law-abiding citizen's right at all. And that's what the court has already concluded in the existing cases. To the extent the court is looking for fresh analogies, I do think those are covered in detail in the various opinions that have been issued in Binderup, in Holloway, and in Falashtar, and were talking about how those apply as binding precedent. If everything were wiped clean and we were on a blank slate, as I said, I think we'd be talking more about whether the analogies cut in favor of the position adopted by Judge Fuentes. But the reason we're not talking about that is that we acknowledge that there is binding precedent that allows for some as-applied challenges to this statute.
Mr. Gottlieb has made the argument that it's inherent in for a regulation's constitutionality that there be some opportunity for restoration of rights. Where do we have that here?
So, of course, there are certain opportunities for restoration in this federal statute, but I think as a matter of constitutional law, the court made clear in Binderup that there is no historical support, is exactly the phrasing it used, no historical support for this idea that someone who commits a serious offense regains their right later. That was, of course, one of the considered judgments this court reached in overruling that aspect of the previous Barton case, as was the court's emphasis on seriousness rather than violence. These are issues that have received serious consideration and remain precedent.
So how would you have us reason, recall from some of the questions that members of the court asked in Binderup, there are examples of things that would qualify as a felony under the federal statute, they have been treated as replacing ketchup that's fallen on the floor, for example. I take it you're saying that there is enough room in the test for analogies that sort of offense would not be an as applied matter that a disarmament there would be deemed unconstitutional. Is that right?
I want to make sure to give the right answer to that. So I think the test that we're talking about is the Binderup test, and I'm not sure what the result would be under the Binderup test for those examples to the extent they are classified as felonies. Of course, we have this court's decision in Falashtar that's a generally conclusive determination, but we also have the portion at the end of Falashtar that applies directly here about why, for the type of offense we're dealing with here, willfully defrauding the government of thousands of dollars, that's just not the type of offense that supports a constitutional right to have a firearm over a congressional determination that this class of people should be barred.
But what is the test? I understand you think it does, is permissible here, but you say that there may be other offenses where it's not permissible. What's the principal distinction? What is the difference in, if we're looking at analogies as wide ranging as simply committing a serious offense, how do we draw that distinction among different kinds of offenses that have been deemed by state legislatures to constitute felonies?
I think that is the issue that the Binderup decisions were trying to resolve, and what the controlling opinion from Judge Ambrose said is that we have these many factors which are not exhaustive, which help us assess how seriously the legislature determined that the crime should be punished, how serious the crime was. And the court explained there that legislative judgments regarding virtue, which is the historical touchstone the court relied upon, do evolve. And so that's where these factors came from, is recognizing that combination of we're tying to history to find the test for that we're talking about serious crimes, but we're also trying to get a sense of how serious of a crime did the legislature think this was.
Does that draw us into looking at that are individual to this defendant?
I think it can, and did in Binderup, but it also, is not sort of a complete case-by-case analysis to the extent there is some category that a particular challenger fits in that can plainly be disarmed as a whole. And so here that category can be thought of as fraud offenders, certainly. It can also be thought of as people who meet the relevant factor of the cross-jurisdictional consensus showing that this 5-year maximum punishment that made Mr. Range eligible for this statute is not an outlier. It's in fact the mainstream.
Does it still matter what sentence the defendant actually received?
I think this court in Holloway explained why that's often not a particularly informative factor, because the question under history and tradition is the offense, not the offender. But of course, it still does have some relevance under the Binderup factors. And, that it was mentioned in Binderup itself as a reason why that challenge succeeded, but it is often not going to be nearly as informative as the maximum punishment that the legislature set. And I think Holloway is very helpful on that point.
How is there any historical analogy for those kinds of considerations in disarming someone? Wasn't it based, as we look back at these statutes in the colonial period and just before, just after the most relevant period, according to the Supreme Court, where is there any historical basis for looking to the length of prison time that someone received in deciding whether or not they're going to be disarmed?
I think this court has exhausted this in its cases, talking about the historical evolution of a felony, talking about how that has sort of legislative judgments about what should count as a felony and what the punishment should be have evolved. But when you look to these historical touchstones of serious crimes and of the other analogies to the founding, what's relevant to look at today includes what type of offense the legislature is dealing with today. And of course, again, to the extent the court is looking at these matters completely fresh, I think we'd welcome an opportunity to discuss that further in any briefing, because our point here is that these arguments have been considered thoughtfully in the court's published decisions in Vindara, Holloway, and Falashtar, and there's no basis for concluding there's a conflict as would be necessary with Bruin as to step one.
Judge Roth, do you have any further questions?
I have no further questions, thank you.
Judge Krause?
No, thank you.
Okay, counsel, thank you very much. Mr. Greenlee, we will hear you for a short rebuttal.
Thank you. I just wanted to quickly touch on historical analogies. First is a quote from Bruin that says, if earlier generations addressed the societal problem, but did so through materially different means, that could be evidence that a modern regulation is unconstitutional. And I just wanted to point out that's what we saw with larceny. They did not punish that by disarming people. Secondly, I'd like to note that the closest historical analogy provided in this case was the 1786 Massachusetts law provided on page 32 of our brief. And that's dealt with somebody actually stealing money from the government. There, if a tax collector collected the tax money from the public and instead of giving it to the government, kept it for himself, then the sheriff would hold an estate sale, sell off the tax collector's goods to recover the amount that he stole, but the tax collector's firearms were expressly exempt from that sale. And then if the sheriff took the money from the estate sale and kept it for himself rather than giving it to the government, so if he also stole from the government, his firearms were exempted from the estate sale as well. And lastly, that's consistent with the 1792 Federal Uniform Militia Act, which exempted firearms from all suits, distresses, executions, or sales for debt or for the payment of taxes. So that's not quite stealing money from the government, but it's not paying money to the government that belongs to it. And they were allowed to keep their arms too. But if there's no further questions, that's all, Your Honor.
Okay. On behalf of the panel, thank you all for the excellent arguments today and for being available so promptly so we could proceed to consider this case. The court will take the matter under advisement.